Hey, it's Greg Brady. Thanks for checking out the Toronto Today podcast for January the 18th, a Tuesday show today. And wow, we are digging out and getting out from under a massive blizzard. Don't overuse the word blizzard, okay? The next time we get 6 centimeters, that was not a blizzard. There's no blizzard-like conditions. That's yesterday. That gets its own documentation and verbiage. It's pretty bad. So we talk a lot about that on the show, and as well get to many other things, including a student for a student advocacy group named Sophia Alexanian that is taking a stand and saying, we want a voice. We want to be heard. This can't just be about the government, the Minister of Education, the Premier, the teachers, the boards, the unions. Kids need a voice also, and we have not done right by them in not giving them as much of a voice as we should have done in the last 18, 19 months when it comes to schools. That's for sure. So we get there on this edition of Toronto Today, which begins now.
Yesterday was really something. I heard two things, and we want to be the pulse of the city. This show does, Toronto Today. We want to feel your heartbeat while you feel ours. That's a bizarre song lyric. But what I heard was kids got outside. Kids were kids again. As we said about half an hour ago, almost nobody talked about COVID-19 yesterday, which was great. Look, it's still real. It's still intense. It's still concerning. There's trepidation about schools. We're going to have a great guest on, a student advocate for safe schools in this go back in about 12 minutes from now. I spoke to her yesterday, and this is a live interview, but I spoke to her yesterday just to make sure she was comfortable with the process, and she's going to come on with us. She's a grade 11 student, 16-year-old, brilliant. You will really enjoy this chat coming up around 7:20 this morning. But people just like were smiling at each other and helping each other and being neighborly. And we've got to get back to that. No one's wearing masks outside. And if they are, it's because blowing snow blowers are everywhere and they don't want a giant snow blow sandwich right in the nose and mouth where we emit droplets, allegedly. No, we do. But I just thought people were wonderful towards each other yesterday in difficult times. And I hope that's a strategy, that's a policy, if you will, that we can carry forward. And as I've said, I've used the metaphor of the boat moving the other way down the river from fear and chaos and concern. And that's a big start yesterday. It's just people being kids, being kids, and parents spending that time with kids. And we still got work to do. Tomorrow's a really, really important day in schools. Speaking of schools, if you show up at school today, anywhere in the GTA, in essence, you're likely to hear this.
Sorry, folks, park's closed. The moose out front should have told you.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's dropping their kid off going, have a great day, the storm's over. No, don't do that. Do not do that. My dad was like that. He would drive me to school. We'd have like fog delays. And he'd be like, well, I got to get to where I'm going. So you're like, as in his school in the city, which was never delayed. And our school out in the country, Medway High School, was constantly delayed. And quick story. I remember him driving me to school one day, and we pass a neighbor, and the girl's in the same grade as me. And she's like very pretty, very well-to-do, very pretty. She was really cute. And, if you're allowed to have crushes on about 6 girls at the same time, she was one of those 6. That's just how it operates in 7th grade, okay? But my dad's like, oh, there's what's her name. Should I pull over and offer to give her a ride to school? Because she's waiting for the bus. I'm like, oh, God, Dad, please don't do that. And he does it anyway. And she's like, no, thanks. She's not. And then, oh my gosh, that takes about 3 weeks of awkwardness to work away. I'm like, no, dad, you don't. You know, my dad was more in the Doug Ford mode yesterday, where he's picking people up on and helping them out. And weirdly, my dad was a high school history teacher and not running for reelection. It's weird how that works itself out. More on that in a little bit. I wanted to bring this up, is the concept of where we're going with airport testing in a bit. But I noticed this study. I noticed this study from the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson's under a lot of heat, right? You've seen this, right? His personal ratings are declining. And I noticed this with Doug Ford yesterday, that his approval rating is down to about 30%. Boris Johnson's numbers have been hugely down Can the Prime Minister survive this? We talked about this last week with Paul Waldy from the Globe and Mail, who's based in London. Well, you know, eventually we all move on to different stories, and the heat you feel, or a politician feels, or anybody in the public eye feels, usually dissipates after 24, 48 hours. That's just where it's at. But here's a poll from YouGov in the UK. And sometimes I just sort of sniff my sniffy nose up at polls. Like if 52% approve of something, that doesn't tell us very much because we're a very divided society right now. But I thought this was significant. On December 16th in the UK, and we're localizing the lead here. And I'm going to bring this back around to Ontario. Don't you worry about it. Fully 75% of people in the United Kingdom on December 16th felt that COVID was getting worse in the UK. Think about how you felt December 16th. That's the Thursday before schools are getting out. You've been told to shave down your holiday gatherings. Don't have them at all. Some were yelling. That might have been going into that weekend when we had pandemic Pete's. Stop moaning. Stop complaining. This is we had that. That's around that time that we had that. So think about how that made you feel internally. And how you feel matters. How you feel in terms of readjusting to where you go and what you do and who you see. We were doing all that stuff. 75% of people in the United Kingdom on that day thought COVID was getting worse. 9% felt it was getting better. They just did another poll a week ago. 38%, up from 9%, felt it was getting better. 37%, down from 75%, felt it was getting worse. What do I read into that? Public anxiety is falling away as fast as the Omicron wave itself. I don't know how else to put it when I see those poll numbers. The cohort of scientists in the UK, they have modeling in the UK also, kind of like our Ontario Science Table. The cohort of scientists in the UK projected disaster. If we don't lock down for Christmas, we will have a disaster. We will have bodies in parking lots, and we will be carrying corpses out of home. Like, honestly, they tried to scare everybody in the United Kingdom. And that disaster kind of failed to materialize. It spectacularly failed to materialize. So it left people with questions. And probably you have those same questions here about Ontario. What about the previous restrictions? What about all those months that we have spent in Ontario, where you are, trying to navigate these regulations? I don't know anywhere that has our restrictions right now in Europe or in, obviously, the United States or anywhere else in Canada. Kids are playing minor hockey right now in Alberta. Older folks who need to go play. Look at what just happened yesterday. Where can you go for a walk? You want a 78-year-old to get his exercise shoveling snow today instead of swimming laps or having a safe personal training session with a boosted personal trainer? Well, that 78-year-old's boosted as well, indoors, where he can then, you know, take a shower, sit in the sauna, make his own choices. Where do you want that to happen right now? So what happened in the UK also is significant because there are all these parties last week I look at. And, you know, last week these parties, we can start to get news of it. And I wonder in my own mind, does it reinforce sort of a suspicion that a lot of the last 2 years of what we've done hasn't changed very much? That the pandemic was going to do and the virus was going to do what it was going to do. And if government isn't taking rules seriously, and they weren't in the UK, and we've had examples here in Ontario, across the country in other provinces, officials at the federal level, although less so this Christmas than last Christmas, is it that government's not taking the rules seriously because they know that part of it is theater and that some of the restrictions are pointless? One-way arrows in grocery stores still exist. I'm in a grocery store on Sunday night, all right, before the storm comes as we start to go shopping and whatnot. And these things come over the loudspeaker about every 90 seconds. Blah, 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 blah. Staying safe, working together, staying 6 feet away from other customers. And then, so if you're in the grocery store for 20 minutes, you're hearing this 9 times. I can't imagine. I used to work in music retail, and in the Christmas season, after you'd heard the same Christmas song 3 times, you were about to burst. And that's in normal circumstances. I can't imagine grocery store workers hearing this message. It's very Orwellian. Take those off. Take the plastic barriers down. Take the arrows away. because no one wants to think that they've been taken for fools. The public has gone along with many of our restrictions, and we sure did at the beginning. We needed to, right? Absolutely. We needed to save long-term care. We needed to protect our elderly. We didn't want any kind of circumstance that left people vulnerable. So we gave authorities trust, even though we thought, well, some of this stuff is really absurd. So I wonder, there's a rage towards politicians, right? There's a rage in the UK towards Boris Johnson. You're mad right now in Ontario at Doug Ford. You're mad maybe at Justin Trudeau. But some of that is also maybe you being embarrassed. Maybe you feel even a little bit of shame that we've gone along to get along for as long as we have. For as long as we have. Everybody was wrong about what would happen in the United Kingdom, thus the dramatic shift of opinion. Okay? So if we're going out of this particular pandemic, maybe the way out is understanding the dramatic shift in opinion can dictate policy. Give you another quick poll. 68% in the UK in early December, as the Omicron wave arrived, opposed closing pubs and restaurants. I would bet you we'd have a lower number here. 64% opposed a stay-at-home order. I bet you we'd have a lower number here. We've been in Ontario, for the most part, compliant. And remember, we're in a tricky situation here. We have a right-of-center government, we do have that, who's locked us down harder than anybody else on planet Earth right now. I understand some of the reasons and motivation as to why. And we have no opposition parties yelling, the lockdown's too harsh. So it's up to you, and it's up to me, and it's up to all of us to say, enough's enough. Next week, you open things back up practically, efficiently, and as well with a abundance of caution, to use that phrase. That's the only way out of this that I see. Public anxiety is falling here in Ontario just the same way it is in the UK. And we feel like it's getting better, not worse. Maybe we didn't feel that way on December 16th, but you've seen the tide change, and so have I. Yeah, so earlier today, we had a student on from 11th grade who I just am so impressed by this. And again, I think she's not saying, well, I feel unsafe, but she wants everybody to feel as safe as maybe she feels. We had her on Sophia Alexanian, Ontario Students for COVID Safety, and they put a Twitter account together. And I love that she said, hey, we just don't want to tweet. We just don't want to be an account and get some likes and retweets. And I'm like, thank you, God, someone's actually saying this. But she also documented the struggle. And I maybe coerced her into saying it's a joke, because then she used the J word, that hybrid learning is, that that's the only virtual learning option kids have right now is live streaming in-person classrooms. Nuh-uh. We need a dedicated teacher to go, hi, kids at home, this is your instructor today, and let's get into some grade 11 geography. That's what we need. Here's what she said on the show.
Consider a chemistry classroom, right? The live in-person class is doing a lab. And, you know, what are the online students supposed to do? If it was in a virtual, like, is the teacher supposed to plan some sort of online activity and the lab on, and that puts pressure on the teacher and they're not at their best? And also considering that the teacher is teaching the in-person class, it's a lab, so they're using Bunsen burners, there's clear risk, they need full supervision, and the teacher is also supposed to cater to online kids, so who gets lost in the shuffle? You know, it's both the in-person students and the online students.
You nailed
mostly
it. Exactly.
It's the online students.
Yep. That's how it works. And Sheba Siddiqui joins me now. I mean, with your kids in school, with my kids in school, we've seen this. I mean, there's had to be a pivot and adjustment and whatnot. But the idea of just watching, like I said to her, it's like watching a television show in which other students your age are getting taught by a teacher, and there's no interaction with the online. It's no way to learn. It's not an acceptable alternative.
Absolutely not. It's been detrimental to my kids. So you know what? We did it quite differently this time around for the last 2 weeks, and it actually worked really well. I didn't notice as much of an effect on their mental health negatively as the first time around. So my youngest, obviously we pulled him out. He wasn't in at all. He's five. There's no way I'm doing that to him ever again. But my other kids, we actually contacted their teachers, and we only kept them in for language and math. So things like art, drama, gym, all of that, we pulled them off of virtual. Their teachers were cool with it. One of their teachers actually said, great idea. Guess what? I'm doing the same thing with my kids. They're only in for language and math, and that's it. So they had about 2 hours of virtual school a day. And it worked out really well because they were just hanging out at home. They were playing outside. They were, playing some video games here and there. So they're on a screen. But I noticed a big difference in their mental health. And it's she's right, that student, Sophia. Yeah. How are you going to do a chemistry lab virtually? How does that work? Like, how much pressure that is for the teachers. And then the kids are stressed out about it and worried about their grades and what they're learning and whether they're getting it right. It's just too much pressure. And there's certain things you can't do to these kids anymore. We have to stand up for them. Nobody else is.
And I've had this conversation a million times with parents or even non-parents who say, hey, which age group do you think is taking it the worst? And I'm like, well, we all are, because parents who have older kids like mine, we see the runway running out. University parents are stressful. They're paying full freight, Sheba. Kids are sitting in residence. They've had two or three shots just to even be there. And teachers and professors won't go back and teach in front of them right now. I mean, I love having Dr. Cam on Monday because he calls it out and says, we're not even... I love that you mentioned that about the teacher saying, I don't even put my own kids through this, because he said on our airwaves, unsolicited, their daughter who's graduating from high school, she's not going and sitting and they're paying full flip. He wants her to have a normal university experience. So she'll take a year and wait this out. And it sucks that that even has to be the case, because what's the next school year away? 8 months? We can't find a way to do school properly 8 months from now? You got to be kidding me.
Well, that's what we were saying a year ago.
I know.
Well, a year ago, we were saying, in September, everything's going back to normal. You were talking about masks being off. Look where we are now. So I don't trust anything or anybody anymore. And you have to do what's best for your household, for your kids, for your mental health, for their mental health. That's what we're doing. And honestly, it's working in our household. These kids, I feel, are happy. They do miss their friends, but they're not sitting there on a screen all day listening to a teacher who doesn't want to be there either.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned masks. I want to bring this up and get your read on it, because I know I've been vocal about it. But the CDC in the United States did this a few months back, and the media is just sort of noticing it now in the U.S. They're calling for cloth masks with clear panels so that you can see a teacher enunciate. Here's who. So having a clear plastic panel, I don't know how many of these are easily purchased, because most of the cloths we get are from, you know, Old Navy or The Gap, or you order them online and you can't see people. Lips move, but the CDC says, who's this for? People who are deaf or hard of hearing, young children or students learning to read, students learning a new language, people with disabilities, people who need to see the proper shape of the mouth for making appropriate vowel sounds. I mean, to me, this sounds like every single human being under the age of 7, 8.
Yes.
Everybody needs that.
They do. And I would even go a little bit older, actually, in age. And, you know, let's get rid of the masks, Brady. I'm on your side. Obviously not now. But I'd love to see them gone for September.
Oh, I'm April. April.
I know you are.
I know you are. I'm not sure what my fully vaccinated 15-year-old, now that he's with unvaccinated people. There's two things that I think have happened. One, tell me if you agree with this, that you don't necessarily care if your kids are around unvaccinated people. You care less maybe than you did 6 months ago.
No, but that happens every day. They're at school. Not all of those kids are vaccinated.
That happened.
I mean, when they're actually in person, it happens all the time. Even the older grades, they have my older boys have a lot of friends whose parents have chosen not to vaccinate them. Over 12 years old and they're not vaccinated. And that's life. This is the world we live in.
This is
the society we live in. And that's okay. It's got to be okay. It has to be.
Yeah. So I've kept hearing this. Well, it's a short-term solution. There's nothing short-term but 2 years or 2.5 years. Especially at that age. What have I said? You can staple mine to my face for the next half decade, but I want them off my kids. I want them to live the life that I lived. That's all I ask for now. That's what my existence is about.
But they weren't in the middle of a pandemic. You weren't in the middle of a pandemic, right? We do have to keep that in mind. Obviously, I want that too. But I never went through a pandemic. So we do have to make some adjustments. In terms of masks, I think April's a little too early. I don't see that happening. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
I'd love it for September.
Well, you know, we did have the Cold War. The Soviets could have bombed us, could have nuked us at any point in time. Dave knows. We all had plans. We all watched that TV movie the day after. We all were ready to hide under desks. And we thought the nuclear bombs, Dave, would come over Canada. It's an easier geographical reach to come over Alaska and Yellowknife and Whitehorse. And the Soviets could have nuked us any one of those days. We were all ready for it.
Yeah, we were. you know,
that was the biggest thing we were stressed about as kids. It was a great era to live in.
True, actually. You picked out the corner of the basement that you were going to hide in when the.
Very pleased to have our next guest on. The Ontario Students for COVID Safety is a Twitter account that NDP education critic Merritt Stiles gave some shout out to. They're at Trillium for Safety, and they've labeled six demands. And good for them. They're a student advocacy group, because I think we've heard too much of the politics of this, of teachers going back and forth. Students get a say also. Like, they should get a seat at the table. And that's the only way a lot of this period gets fixed post-COVID, is to allow people to have an opinion and pull up a chair and say what they want and they need at this particular point. From that group is Sophia Alexanian. She's from the Ontario Students for COVID Safety, and she's a grade 11 student at Albert Campbell Collegiate, and she joins me now on Toronto Today. Sophia, great to have you on. Thank you very much for making the time for me and our listeners.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really grateful for you for platforming our cause and platforming student voice. That's very important at this time. So would you like me to kind of introduce the group from my perspective as a student? Because you mentioned a Twitter account, and our goal is not just to be a Twitter account. I know a lot of people kind of got to know us from the Twitter thread showcasing our demands. But no, we don't just want to be some sort of online platform just to, although it's really good to have that student demands out there, it's not the end goal. You know, I don't want to just make Twitter threads. I don't just want to make infographics for people to share on Instagram. We truly want to take action. We want to organize students to actually have these demands implemented through whatever direct action it takes.
So it's not 100%.
It's not just about a social media presence, although it is really good, and it's really good that the education critic kind of is aware of our existence, and hopefully that translates to some sort of real action taken by our provincial government. But
well, I'll tell you something. I'll tell you something, Sophia. I can spot, and you're pretty astute too. Yeah, I think people now can kind of spot grandstanding and doing something to do something and sort of to talk the talk instead of walking the walk. I can spot that stuff a mile away. That's not what I see with your group here. And 2 weeks ago, I think I put out a tweet and I said, kids don't have unions, and they don't. And that's not a crack at the teachers' union. My parents taught their whole life, and the union's a valuable resource. But you guys need to, you guys get a say, and you certainly should get more prominence in discussions about what education is, how safe schools are, and where we're going moving forward. So I'm happy to platform you.
Yeah, exactly. Students are a major stakeholder in this, and it's important that we have our own sort of voice. Well, teachers, yes, are really important, and when they advocate for labor rights of having a safe workplace, their workplace is our school, so it translates hopefully to a safer school for us. Students are also have their own unique needs in this situation and also deserve to have their own voice heard in this.
What are, so you list a thread, your account lists a thread of demands. I have it in front of me, but lay it out for our listeners in terms of what you think makes for a safe or at least much safer learning environment that might not exist in some schools starting tomorrow. What do you want that you're not sure is there and adequate just yet?
Well, to begin with that, I should provide some context on where the demands came from. This came from us in the group reaching out and talking to our classmates over kind of the months of frustration that we had over COVID, seeing what was missing. And all that frustration and kind of hearing the same things mentioned over and over again, that students don't feel safe, and this is why, this is what some that is missing. Based on that, we kind of tried to make a more concise list of what specifically students want. So one of that is to continue to collect and report on COVID-19 data in schools. The current plan is to wait until there's a 30% absenteeism in schools among students and staff to report an outbreak. And this is just completely unacceptable to students. Students do have a right to know about what's going on in their schools and what's going on province-wide with the state of COVID-19 outbreaks in schools. So that's one key point that a lot of students were really anxious about. Another point is that while teachers groups have called for proper N95 or KN95 masks for teachers, and from what I hear, they're in the process of granting that, students have yet to be provided with proper masks. And we know that this is an airborne variant. This is an increasingly transmissible variant. Proper masks are needed. So students think that it should be the responsibility of the provincial government to provide the funding and the supplies of these masks to students that are so necessary for a safe return to school. Also, a lot of students were really concerned that there was a lack of a proper strategy following COVID-19 illness and COVID-19 exposure, that there was a lack of a proper policy for returning to class and making sure people are safe to return to class, which is why a lot of students were really happy about a test to return strategy, to have the provincial government support that and make sure that schools have continued access to PCR testing. That is a huge part of that. And another key point, and this is something that hasn't been really talked about outside of education circles. I only hear educators mention this, and all those students have suffered through this, and they were concerned. Now we're finally mentioning it. This is there's a need for a proper virtual school.
Yeah.
Like currently, the remote learning option that was being offered by schools was the live streaming of in-person classrooms. This is completely inadequate as an online learning option. A lot of students who maybe feel the need to stay home or want to stay home, they're concerned because it's a poor quality of education to just have a in-person classroom be live streamed to you, rather than have a proper, with a dedicated virtual teacher who can kind of use the tools available in an online learning environment to provide a good education experience. Like,
The hybrid, let me jump in. The hybrid's a total joke. So I'm glad you're bringing this up. And I have brought that up on this show. And I'm so glad you're amplifying it now. Because to me, a student like you in grade 11, it's like watching a television show of somebody teach a class. They're not speaking directly to you. They're not catering to kids that are at home. And if kids need to stay home or feel the need in these first couple months to stay home, Sophia, they should. And they should get a dedicated service and a dedicated teacher, not just video of somebody teaching a live classroom. It's a joke.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like it's not really understood by people who are outside of that environment of how much of an exact joke this is. Like, consider a chemistry classroom, right? The live in-person class is doing a lab. And, you know, what are the online students supposed to do? If it was in a virtual, like, is the teacher supposed to plan some sort of online activity and the lab on, and that puts pressure on the teacher and they're not at their best? And also considering that the teacher is teaching the in-person class, it's a lab, because they're using Bunsen burners, there's clear risk, they need full supervision, and the teacher is also supposed to cater to online kids. So who gets lost in the shuffle? You know, it's both the in-person students and the online students.
You nailed
it.
Exactly.
Online students.
It's mostly the online students. I'm tight for time here, but I want to point people towards your account. Tell me in a minute what the next step is. How can you get on conference calls? How can you link up with teachers and say, we've got your back, but we want you to have ours? This can't just be about what a teachers union determines or a school board determines. We have a voice. Our parents pay the taxes for us to come to school. That matters too. So how do we get our voice heard more? What happens next?
Well, we're really lucky that there's a large overlap between what we want and what teachers groups, school boards, what they also want, because it's all evidence-based demands, evidence-based claims that are all essential for safety. Safe schools matter to all of us, all the stakeholders present. But the next steps would be to really organize students within their individual schools to take a stand, to reach out to their teachers, to talk, to organize some form of direct action. Our group was inspired by the students in Manitoba who staged a walkout on Monday to protest their unsafe return to school. That sort of direct action could really get the attention and show that we do have power as students. So those are hopefully the next steps.
Will you stay in touch with our show on this? I'm so pleased that you were on. I'm so happy you made the time for us. And I know you want to get back to in-person also and road test this, but also ask for more things. And don't stop using that voice. It's so vital. I know how much you want this all over with, but it's got to be done the right way. And we got to navigate this for students like you. I think we've wronged you guys and girls by not doing enough in the last year and a half for students. We've worried about everything else, and we've put you guys last. It's no good.
Yeah, thank you so much again for platforming this. And yeah, we will keep in touch because this is going to be an ongoing thing. This is going to be a fight until we do really have safe schools in Ontario.
Now, if I told you, this is numbers from the Canadian Institute for Health Information, hospitalizations, right? We've talked a lot about it with COVID. How about 4,300 additional hospital stays for chronic medical conditions related to alcohol? That could be a pancreas problem. That could be liver disease. And that's in the first 16 months of the pandemic in Canada. And last I checked, we're a lot deeper into 16 months. We all know people who, you know, they go through a breakup or job loss or something, or death of a family member, and alcohol might be something they turn to, but it's for a brief and finite period of time. That's not what's happening here, and it's greatly, greatly concerning. I want to bring on our next guest. He's a family physician with Unity Health in Toronto, and he was quoted in a recent newspaper article on this, and it's an important light to shine upon a crisis, one of many. COVID is one, but there are many. Dr. Andrew Pinto is our guest on Toronto Today. Dr. Pinto, thank you for making the time for our listeners today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I lay that out there, and like I said, oftentimes people who are not alcoholics, high functioning or otherwise, might, you know, dip into alcohol a little bit to get them through a brief and finite period of time. As I mentioned, that's not what this pandemic has been, and something that they might have thought, well, you know, this will get me through 3 or 4 weeks. We're talking about 100 weeks or pretty close to it now, and people are clearly still having a struggle putting alcohol aside.
That's exactly right. And it's something that I'm seeing in my clinical work. And it's also what the numbers are showing in terms of the research that's been done, that people during this time, there has been an increase in people drinking. It kind of has focused on folks who are more middle-aged, so people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, many of whom are dealing with a lot of different stresses at the same time during the pandemic. You know, work that's been done earlier in the pandemic asked people why were they turning to alcohol? And it was because of the things that you mentioned, social isolation, stress, feeling bored, feeling lonely, and dealing with things like insomnia or not being able to sleep. So this has become a big issue, and it is associated with really the lockdown and the public health measures that have been put in place to help protect our health system. But we're seeing that folks are sometimes turning to alcohol. And what's, I think, a key issue is it's concentrated in folks who are dealing with other important social issues like not having enough income, the stress of not having work, and being isolated from other folks.
And Dr. Pinto, this is also, you know, in this a year, close to 2 years now, we've curtailed our ability, and we've been limited, whether it's by choice or not, to be able to socialize. So whether it's been traveling, where we might have an extra drink or two, university students have had a much different existence, work parties, those have been, you know, cut down to a bare minimum, and yet we're still seeing these problems, which tells anybody that people are drinking at home, they're drinking in isolation, they're drinking as a couple, a husband, a wife, a boyfriend, girlfriend, and it's still leading to these problems.
Yeah, indeed. We did see that there was a drop in alcohol consumption for people who are younger for most, which was because of things like closing bars and restaurants and young folks not getting together for parties with others. So that did happen too. But exactly, this is now kind of a way that people are coping with stress and coping with isolation and just the struggle that they're going through. And it's another example of how during the pandemic, we've not all been experiencing it the same. We know that, you know, folks who are dealing with low income, who have been out of work, have been really challenged. This is one of the reasons, you know, I want to convey to listeners is this is a really important issue for your health, and to reach out to your family doctor, to reach out to your caregivers, to be able to, you know, open up about this, because there are things that can help folks with dealing with the stress that's not turning to alcohol.
Dr. Andrew Pinto is our guest, a family physician with Unity Health in Toronto. I'm glad you went there, and I'm glad you said that, because that leads me to ask if you're seeing people, you know, that are, you know, again, husbands, wives, mothers, fathers, who maybe I could say this anecdotally, and you owe them confidence and anonymity, they'd be the last people you think would have a problem. But the pandemic has turned a lot of lives, pushed a lot of lives off their axis, and all of a sudden they are having those kind of struggles with a substance, with some form of abuse or at least excessive use.
Yeah, as you say, it sometimes can start gradually, where people are coping with things like stress by having a few extra, and then it becomes part of a daily routine, mm-hmm. and then it becomes something that they then need to help cope with things, and even you know just to deal with things like anxiety and loneliness. It's also, alcohol is something that's is fairly socially acceptable. We know that about 2/3 of Canadians have had a drink in the last month or so. So it's a very common behavior, but it can be very easy that it kind of slips into routines, becomes something that we rely on. So then the question is, how can we try to help people outside of this? And so one is being able to talk with someone who is a member of your health team to cope with what's going on, to open up, to seek support. If you're dealing with anxiety, dealing with things like grief, that's been something that I've seen in my own practices. Folks who have lost people during the pandemic, a lot of them are struggling with the grief. It's been very hard to grieve losses during this time. And to be able to, you know, reach out and find other ways to cope. One simple kind of thing can be having someone to talk to, which could be a counselor or therapist, but also kind of things with our routine, like making sure we're getting outside, getting, you know, a bit of exercise each day, making sure we're trying to, you know, have a good night's sleep and turn off devices and things like that at nighttime as well.
Dr. Andrew Pintz was our guest on Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. He's a family physician with Unity Health in Toronto. We're talking about the data and his own experience as a family physician with just people drinking more. It's fueled more hospitalizations. It's fueled more issues within families. And you bring up something that's really, you know, so interesting and compelling right now. And that is, as we're locked down right now, with the weather being, now let alone the last 2 days, with the weather being what it's been, I think a lot of people said, you know what, I'll put the wine bottles away when life returns to normal, and I won't drink as much when the gym reopens or when my slow pitch league starts again. Well, those things haven't exactly materialized, and they haven't been consistent either. So to your point, we don't have that balance where I can say, well, you know what, I don't mind eating and drinking a little more because I can get back into the gym and work it off. Right? We don't have those outlets for us right now. So it just sits there and it gets worse.
Yeah, it's a very tough time. And I know that we saw a real relationship between the hospitalizations related to alcohol and what people can do. So people have to, you know, think about ways that they can get out and get some exercise, even if things like the gyms are closed. I end up talking with a lot of patients about just the benefit of earlier in the day, getting outside, getting some fresh air, trying to go for a brisk walk, getting on your boots, you know, doing things that expose us to nature, to fresh air, and also, you know, being able to connect with other people safely outdoors, where the risk of transmission of COVID is much lower, in a safe way, and doing those types of things. You know, part of my work is also as a researcher at Unity Health, and we look at kind of how COVID has affected different folks in our society. And this type of, you know, advice and ways of coping is particularly important for folks who are struggling with their work or income or other sorts of things that are impacting them. So one thing as a society is we need to make sure we're actually putting the resources like mental health and counseling towards communities that are going to be the most affected by the things like the lockdown. Mm.
Last thing for you, what are you seeing? I'm pivoting here, but I think our listeners would be curious about it, and I got a couple text messages about it while we're talking to you. What about weight? It's just, it's patently obvious that, you know, I'm not speaking just personally. We've all probably put, you know, an X amount of pounds on, but some people have probably, who haven't, you know, been able to get back into a routine for whatever reason, because they're not as mobile or they work from home. There's just less hustle and bustle. They just haven't been able to take those pounds off since the pandemic started, and it's getting worse.
Yeah, it's a major issue. I mean, you take almost everybody, and people are working from home. They're not engaging in active transportation, like getting out just even to get to work. And it is a real issue. The one thing I'd say is it's important to also take time and to not pour on kind of the shame and mm-hmm. and feeling like, oh, I've gained this weight and it's so bad and I'm unable to control myself. And it's really about taking time to recognize this is something, you know, we're all affected. And while weight gain is something that happens gradually, it's also weight loss can be part of that. And doing things that are just in general good for your health. So trying to eat lots of fruits and vegetables, try to get a bit of activity, taking breaks from work, as simple as, and you see lots of folks doing this during kind of the lunch hour. Even if you're working from home, get outside, get some exercise, put on, you know, your boots and try to get some exercise and activity. This will, you know, come to an end. This will, things will open up, and we can just remain hopeful for that. And also connect with other folks, you know, reaching out and having somebody who you, yeah. you know, challenge each other to engage in these kinds of healthy behaviors can help a lot too.
Dr. Pinto, thank you very much for the time. I really appreciate it, and I hope we get to chat again. I really found this insightful this morning. Thanks for making the time for our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. Dr. Andrew Pinto's family physician at St. Mike's Hospital. There's a lot there. And, you know, you might say, well, it's a tough call to say this person needs Alcoholics Anonymous, this person needs a service just because of behavior during the pandemic. But what would you, well, they didn't drink that much in 2017 or 2018. So what? What does that mean now? Heavy drinking leads to chronic illness. That leads, it's this revolving door, okay? It'll keep spinning around and around. And we're not talking about, like, it was almost funny. Oh, yeah, beer and wine sales have gone through the roof in June of 2020. There's not a lot of people laughing at the people that have been drinking in this process since then. I get it. And some of it has been social. Let's not forget, of course, some of it's been social in backyards and after a golf game and people have gone places. But the outlets just haven't been there. And I'm a social drinker. I like to drink when I'm up and things are good. If I'm down, if I'm depressed, it isn't something that I'm into. But that sure isn't the case for an awful lot of people that have documented this, that I know in my own life have had things go against them the last 20 months or so. So we've had this delay, really, for in-person learning. We would never get really metrics. We'd get emotions. We'd get responses as to how parents, teachers, you know, kids all thought it went, but we're kind of still on hold for this. I want to bring on Dr. Monica Howe, who's the Associate Medical Officer of Health for Peel Region and the lead physician supporting school reopening plans in Peel Region. Dr. Howe, first of all, thank you for making the time this early. I thank you. I thank Dr. Lowe. We've had Patrick Brown on a lot. I think you've all been really innovative and accountable and great leaders during this entire run. So I wanted to thank you for that and making the time. I think we need more like the three of you. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course, absolutely. So, yeah, I lay that out there at the beginning, and we there's going to be a lot of raw emotion. I think we've realized there are elements of the pandemic that have, how would I put it, political aspects to it. Schools are one of those things. But what do you see, and what's been some of the work like for you in the last 2 weeks to ensure a safe return to in-person learning for kids and teachers alike?
Yeah, so certainly we know that there's, as you say, a lot of emotions running with the return of kids to school. And I think overriding it is this, all of it is trying to arm parents with information and their kids on how they can reduce their risk of COVID-19 when they do return. So in the last couple of weeks, what we've really done is enable enhanced access to vaccinations, which is the most important prevention measure that you can take to prevent COVID-19 and complications of serious illness. And so we know that vaccine access for educators has been in a priority, and they've been able to get access to booster doses. The other really important feature that we want to really enhance is access for 5 to 11-year-olds. Those who have, you know, most recently been approved for the vaccine, and we're still really encouraging high first doses. So things like that, you know, reminders around masking, mm-hmm. Good ventilation, screening every day, and keeping your kids home if they're sick. All of those combination of measures has been really important to help prepare for back to school.
Doctor, what do you see in your region for, I mean, anecdotally, it sounds like 5 to 11 vaccines is around the 50% range. Maybe it's grown a little bit, but I've heard 12 to 17 is closer to 80, 85%. There's been a lot of uptake, and they've had longer periods of time, no question about it, about seven months now for 12 for high school students in grade 7s and 8s to get vaccinated. What are the numbers that you see in your region?
Yeah, so that's exactly it. Is around the 12 to 17-year-old age group has had more time, and we're really impressed with how, like, overall the uptake in the vaccination community. We know it continues to grow. So, yeah, so it's around 75% to 80% for that particular age group. And for the 5 to 11 age group, we are seeing around 44-45% now with the first doses. And we, you know, are really impressed with 50,000 of these kids in Peel getting vaccinated already, and we'd love to see that number grow higher.
Dr. Monica Howe is our guest, joining us, the Associate Medical Officer in Peel Region on Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. Let me ask you about two things that are, I think people have asked questions about. There's contact tracing, and there's sort of test to return, or as it's called in the States, test to stay. I think we're wondering about testing to be able to come back for teachers or students that have had symptoms and tested positive for COVID. I think those are important safeguards. I think the tracing, and I think a lot of epidemiologists agree on this, it's so out of control right now. Omicron's run so, I think there's better places to put resources. Give me your thoughts first on the ability to trace. It's really, really difficult to be able to get into schools and classrooms and cohorts and trace the virus at this point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. At this point, we know that it is a highly transmissible virus, but thankfully it is less severe. Mm-hmm. The reliability of your ability to test, trace, and isolate is certainly hampered by the speed, but also with the tools that we have available at this time. You know, the Ministry of Health has really directed health units to focus on the highest risk settings. Well, we do know the more vulnerable individuals may be in hospital, long-term care, retirement homes, or other congregate living settings like shelters. So we're focusing our efforts. We know we want to have the biggest impact to protect the most vulnerable. That's not to say that we're not focusing our efforts on as much as we can on kids, of course, and staff, of course. And so we're really moving and shifting the approach to COVID in general community settings like schools and childcare to one of a symptom management approach, similar to other cold and flu viruses out there.
What do you see, Dr. Howe, in your hospitals right now? Some documentation in Ontario suggested that there are some pediatric admissions, but most are 0 to 5. And I do think parents do bring their kids. This is a high time for rotavirus season. I know, of course, some of that is COVID related, but the data I'm seeing, I don't want to say there's practically nobody in a hospital from age 6 to 46, but this seems like there is a pediatric level that we're watching carefully, and then almost everybody else practically being hospitalized seems to be over 50. What are some of the demographics you're seeing? I think that'd be so helpful for our listeners.
Yeah, so we're certainly keeping an eye on the hospitalization data very closely, because that is the ultimate outcome that we're really concerned about. And what we do see is that although the number of hospitalizations are high because of how transmissible it is, we are seeing differences both in kind of the length of stay for people than compared to other variants. They seem to be
like much better than Delta, much shorter stays than Delta, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. Less need for ICU admission. And within the pediatric population, those less than 20, it is still the lowest age group for hospitalization compared to every other age group. And within that, it is the 0 to 4, that is that age group that is ineligible for vaccination, the smaller lungs, that may have the highest risk of hospitalization within the kids, but still overall lower compared to others.
Thank you very much for your insight this morning. Like I said, I think you and Dr. Lowe have been you've been great guests with our radio station and for putting data and concepts of how to stay safe out there. Thank you very much for making the time for our audience today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You bet. Dr. Monica Howe, Associate Medical Officer of Health for Peel Region.
Thanks for listening to the Toronto Today podcast. We appreciate it. We're back with a live show tomorrow on 640 Toronto at 5:30 in the morning, all the way through till 9 o'clock. So check us out in any of those windows over 3.5 hours. And we'll have another podcast for you right here. Please feel free to subscribe, tell a friend, and spread the word. Thanks very much and have a great Tuesday.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.